Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Okay, lots of things to talk about. Obviously, the Russians have invaded Ukraine, but I'm curious as to how far this is going to go. I never thought there was going to be a world war here. I know I've disagreed with Dr. Pry on this. I never thought there was going to be a massive battle, but it always made sense that Russia, you know, would anytime they wanted to, you know, walk into Ukraine, especially since they disarmed back 30 years ago with the agreement that Britain and the United States would protect them against exactly what's happening right now. Well, of course, we know what that's worth. And so that's the situation we find ourselves in watching this, because we know Brandon's not going to go to war. He already said, well, U.S. troops aren't going to go. So here's a guy that causes this all to happen. He's up to his butt or higher, up to his neck in Ukraine corruption. We don't even know what that's about. We don't know what backroom deals. We don't know, you know, how corrupt the previous government was, how much it, in exchange for money, you know, sucked up to the Obama administration. So the real details of this, we don't know. I mean, and life is complex and you only know so much, but it does look like there's somewhat of a limited invasion. If it were a total invasion, they'd be destroying everything. They'd be wiping out everything, you know, just going all the way across Ukraine. But, you know, as so many people have explained, Ukraine's rich in minerals, various other, you know, things. it's a fascinating, like I say, it's quite an interesting story what's going on. And now the Ukraine military is mobilizing and they're drafting people. And I'm thinking, well, why'd you wait this long? You know, with that many troops on the border, you know, sort of this is almost expected. So the question now is, and I'm a little surprised. I really am. And so I'm sort of thinking to myself, I'm sort of the challenge is how much did I predict was going to happen? How much was I wrong about? And so we'll see. So I wasn't sure with the invade. I mean, I knew they always could. What I was sure about, and I'm still sure about, is that we're not going to go to war over this. We aren't. The United States isn't. The polls, the ratings, you know, the sympathy, the support for the United States getting involved in this is so low, you know, especially after Brandon's surrender to the Taliban, is so low that it's doubtful that anything, you know, is going to happen. I mean, the idea of sanctions. The sanctions are another problem, too. This is kind of funny. Well, we're going to sanction them. We're going to hurt them economically. Well, Russia's already hurt economically, you know, by the fact that they have a communist economy. So that slows them down. But what's fascinating was I was watching a report on One American News. Christina Bob and this gentleman, Holly, what's his first name? Derek Holly, president of Reaching America. And so I'm going to have to take a look at that. Anyway, what I was saying is, and this is quite interesting, that this is all about energy. This is all about oil, petroleum, natural gas. This is about energy. And most of the world's affairs have been about energy. Who controls energy controls everything. So whereas we, you know, were in control of our country when we had energy independence, when the oil and gas leases ran out, they were able to be extended in the Trump administration, you know, when, you know, the price of energy was low, when we had a strategic petroleum reserve, you know, when it was an open market. You know, and we produced as much as we needed. And if foreign sources were cheaper, we bought them. And when they got expensive, we drilled more of our own. So there was a balance. That's how the market's supposed to work. All right. And so things were working fine. I mean, they're perfectly fine. Gas was under $2 a gallon. There was plenty of it. Our energy was driving our country and inflation was low and the economy was booming. Well, that's what happens when the price of energy is low. When you raise the price of energy, when you make it scarce, and I think it's approaching over $100 a barrel now, you know, everything goes up. Everything that travels by truck goes up. Everything that happens in the economy goes up. And when they borrowed trillions of dollars to, you know, for stimulus to cure the COVID situation that the government caused, you know, COVID would have been over with. COVID was a virus, and, you know, I mean, we can debate forever whether it was government created and introduced. I happen to think it was. It was engineered as a marketing product for these new vaccines, which aren't vaccines, these messenger RNA things. And so if you look at COVID as a government, corporate, fascist, you know, mandated marketing plan, it all makes sense. But it never had to happen that way. So that brings about a whole difference to this. But, you know, point being that the whole Brandon illegal government problem, hassle, everything he's done has been wrong. And now they want to blame it all on Ukraine. That's the funny thing, even though they're not going to do anything about Ukraine. So Putin looking at Brandon, you know, being weak, not even being a legal president, he knows it. The rest of the world knows this. They know Brandon's not legally there. So the question is, you know, is this a good time to go into Ukraine? Sure. It's probably a good time for China to go into Taiwan. I mean, I hate to say that. I think Taiwan's going to have a little more objection. And my point of sending 500,000 AR-15s to both Ukraine and Taiwan, I think would have been a good thing to do as a deterrent. Plus the fact that Ukraine should have rearmed themselves long ago. You know, the idea of relying on British and American protection in the face of Russia, which is right on their border, was kind of stupid. You know, and so there we find ourselves. But are we going to go to war over this? No. Is it going to go into a nuclear war? No, because nobody wants it. Europe doesn't want a war. They don't want a war with Russia. Germany certainly doesn't. And this is what we've been saying all along. So given the vacuum of power, given the lack of opposition in Western Europe, given the, you know, the NATO, I mean, Ukraine's not a NATO country, so there's no obligation for NATO to defend them. You know, treaty-wise, the only one is this Budapest Memorandum, which I don't even know if it's binding, which says if Ukraine gives up their nuclear weapons, which are Russian, then the West will defend them. And they didn't, because Russia's there. So, you know, what is it about nature in a vacuum? So this is where we find ourselves. So it's very interesting. So I think this is going to be a lot of yelling and screaming by Brandon. He's going to make his State of the Union, his sorry State of the Union. In fact, that's what I think. I'll make a video, Brandon's sorry State of the Union. But that's all being brought about by Brandon. You know, there wouldn't be any of this if it wasn't for Brandon. It didn't happen under Trump, and there's a reason it didn't happen under Trump. Trump was a strong leader. You know, Trump didn't let the Nord Stream pipeline go through. Trump, you know, was a force, and Putin knew it. Putin knew that would be a bad time to invade. You know, Trump was getting us out of Afghanistan properly. With the Americans out first, he would have. You know, and we would have brought back our $82 billion worth of weapons, which who knows if the Russians have them now, using them against Ukrainians, or do Ukrainians have them using against Russians? I don't know. I'm just speculating. Anyway, I still don't think there's going to be a major war outbreak. I do think Russia's going, I don't know how far Russia's going to go. You know, I mean, probably to install a government favorable to Russia and then take out the minerals so they can provide more energy. I mean, Ukraine's got oil, uranium, all kinds of things, titanium. There's a whole list of things that Ukraine has. It's a very rich area. You know, Russia needs that stuff. Okay. So there they are. Who's going to kick them out? Ukrainians aren't. They've disarmed. You know, the Western Europe, the Europeans aren't because they don't want a war. Brandon can't because he's incompetent. And the people that are actually running things, they don't want a war. they wanted the propaganda effect. So they want to be able to blame. So they're willing to sacrifice Ukraine so they can blame all of Brandon's problems on Ukraine rather than on Brandon and on themselves. That's what's really going on here. So I found something interesting as I'm looking around. And this is the time on a Friday when Alan Dawson either can or cannot join us. We never really know for sure. He's a busy guy. He's down in Belize. And so when we're lucky enough to get a Belize report, you know, I'm happy to put him on. And he's got the Skype line. So anybody can call in by Skype. And so that's the way to do it if you're international. Usually folks in Canada and Mexico can call in directly because your service includes the United States. So I got the live chats open. I'll try and check it more. Today, like I say, it's just me, so things are different. But anyway, live chat is there, and so you can type in any message. You'll find live chat at the bottom of your broadcast page. So I got a bunch of things to talk about, but let me bring up this this article I found on how U.S. President Biden caused Russia to attack Ukraine, and it's by somebody called Sean S-E-U-N. Opejobi, and this is from Ukraine. This is Ukraine. This is from Nigeria. This is the Daily Post of Nigeria. And again, I like foreign posts because they tend to be a little more objective, especially when looking at us. So Sean Opejobi reported on February 24th, yesterday, this. He says, Reno Omokri, a socio-political activist, blamed the United States, United States President Joe Biden, for Russia's attack on Ukraine. Omokri said President Putin of Russia took advantage of Biden's weakness in Afghanistan to attack Russia. Yeah, no kidding. The former aide to ex-president Goodluck, Jonathan, said Putin smelled Biden's weakness. This is in a tweet. Omokri said Biden's weakness gave Putin the courage to attack Ukraine. According to Omokri, when a dog smells weakness, it will always attack. The weakness that Joe Biden projected during the Afghanistan incident, which we're calling the Afghanistan surrender, is what Putin smelled, and that is what gave him the courage to attack Ukraine. Sometimes you need to pick up your gun for your enemy to drop his. Interesting thought, and I agree. No nation was ever attacked because it was too strong. You know, keep that in mind. That's a Gregism. Anyway, it says Russia had attacked Ukraine's multiple borders, the Border Service reports. The border said the attacks are targeting border units, border patrols, and checkpoints using artillery, heavy equipment, and small arms. So the first thing they did was, as I understand, I've been watching this, you know, as much as I can, air superiority. Well, Ukraine either doesn't have an air force or they lost it in the first few minutes. And so, well, without air superiority, everything else kind of falls apart pretty quickly. So air superiority means the ground forces really aren't going to be touched because no one can get near them because of the air superiority. That's the whole point of having air superiority. So this is the border said the attacks are targeting border units, border patrols, and checkpoints using artillery, heavy equipment, and small arms. I also hear they're targeting the airports. So are they? Is this a massacre of Ukrainians? No, it's not. This is very strategic. You know, and so this is an invasion. And, you know, if they just wanted to obliterate Ukraine, they could. But what point would that serve? See, I've always asked the question, why? Why is this going on? Why is there a war here? Why? Why? What's the big why? What's the big why behind this? So if you're going to go into a country and maybe try and change the government, well, you take out the things that are going to oppose you, the border checkpoints, the airports, the Air Force, you know, and you're going to bring in the tanks and stuff as a show of force. But is Ukraine mounting a huge opposition to this? Well, I mean, they're fighting, obviously, but is it enough opposition to stop Russia? No, because they disarmed. You know, are the people armed? No. You know, is it a democracy? No. You know, so you've got this this crazy situation, you know, so we can't be defending democracy in Ukraine because they don't have one. They got a corrupt government. The only question is whether it's a corrupt Russian-sponsored government or a corrupt American-sponsored government. You know, I mean, this is a corruption fight, if you want to put it that way. It's a corruption fight. And the real war has been waged in a cyber war for probably decades. So in the fight over Ukraine, you know, our cyber folks have been battling their cyber folks. Our corruption's battling their corruption. You know, Brandon and little Hunter Brandon, you know, has been there doing whatever he does. You know, so they've been extracting huge amounts of money from Ukraine for something. And whatever that something is, I think Brandon failed to provide, which is typical Brandon. So whatever Brandon was promised in order to defend Ukraine or whatever he was given, he ain't following through. This is going to be interesting. So this is the part we don't know about the story yet. So we'll see. Anyway, so Russia's doing exactly what I would expect them to do, you know, if they wanted to change the government and they wanted to either seize control or somehow acquire the natural resources of Ukraine. This is what they would do. Okay, like I said, they're not wiping out villages. They're not destroying mass amounts. They're not carpet bombing. They're not doing any of that kind of stuff. Like I say, the tanks are going through, but nobody's really attacking them. So this is very strategic. So what can Ukraine do? Well, of course, they should resist. But this should have started a long time ago. Like I say, if Russia tried to do the same thing in the United States, even if our government let them in, there's still enough small arms that occupying the United States would be unbelievably difficult. I would say impossible. Well, at least in the conservative and the patriotic portions of America, the liberal states that have disarmed, that's another story. That's on them. But yeah, so that's what's happening. Anyway, so it says the service added that Ukraine's border guards, along with Ukraine's armed forces and National Guard, are firing back at its Air Force. Shut down, and its Air Force, this Russian Air Force, shot down, Ukrainian Air Force shot down 5 Russian planes and several attack helicopters. Well, yeah, I wonder if they're using Stinger missiles. I wonder if they're using our missiles. Anyway, that's a story from Nigeria, and I find this all quite fascinating what's going on. So we've got Shirley Wachell coming up in about 15 minutes, and she'll be doing a DC Project Women and Guns, and she was the one that brought that amazing guest on, Jeanette Sharp, who ended up staying for the whole show. The whole rest of the show was great. She's from New Zealand. And so I'll be working more with New Zealand folks. Right now I'm very much preoccupied with two things. One, getting my website back, writeyourlaws.com. We had a problem with writeyourlaws.com when we lost our webmaster, Eric Colley. Somehow the website got taken out. And I'm not sure, you know, well, I know there's some details about that. It's not really important. But what is important is that the site is down, and I'm going to do my best to get it back up and running as soon as possible, hopefully today. And the reason for that is because the truckers, you know, I've talked to, you know, Bernadette Pittman and R.C. Pittman, who run Northwest Florida Bikers for Trump, and Kip Colson, who was on the show before, too. I haven't talked to him since the show, but I hope to. But the folks that are going to Washington are going to be presenting our bills to everybody, Congress, the media, you know, they're going to be lobbying, actually going to be going hopefully into Congress and talking to various representatives, unlike the Canadian truckers that weren't allowed in Parliament to talk to anybody. So that was a problem in Canada. They didn't talk to anybody. Right? idiots. So I'm hoping that they'll be able to talk to some folks in Congress and some folks in the media, and we'll see what happens. I mean, it depends on what they want to do. But my job is to get the site up as soon as possible so they have access to those bills so they can then discuss them, share them, send them to everywhere, and everybody can take a look. And so if anybody's trying to do that right now with RightYourLaws.com, it's down today, hopefully back today, and so that you guys, the truckers, and everybody else in the country who wants to can see the bills we proposed and bring those directly to media and Congress. I would say media first, because Congress is the last place that's going to move, because especially for some of those bills, they're so beholden to their donors. They're not going to be able to do anything with them. So I found something interesting I want to get to just quickly here, and then we'll go on to tackling what is going on with Where's my Nigerian post? Move that around. Take my second article. Here we go. Now, that's not the one I wanted. There's an article that came out in Gateway Pundit. So here's what's happening about Trudeau's executive orders. What you don't hear about, and I think this is the most fascinating part, is that the orders have been rescinded. And I don't see where I put it. Let me find out where I put it here. Sorry about that. Live radio. I know I shouldn't be doing this. I should have this all organized. I wish I did. Ah, here we go. Found it. Now, see, it's not so bad. Things get better here. So this is there's a video from Rebel News, and there's an article in Gateway Pundit. And this is from the 23rd. It says, breaking, in a shocking reversal, Trudeau revokes his use of Emergencies Act. And they says lack of Senate support likely forced his hand. So the Parliament approved it, but the Senate said, I don't know about that. You know, I also heard there was a mountain of lawsuits awaiting him over this Emergency Powers Act, and that really wasn't too popular either. But what's really interesting is that the mainstream news has not proclaimed, yes, the people win, you know, the truckers win. Trudeau backs down and dumps his emergency orders. In fact, you haven't heard anything about it. I just heard a little news clip and started looking it up, and I found this in Gateway Pundit. So article is from the 23rd by Julian Condrison. And so it's from February 23rd. There we go. All right. So Julian says, just 2 days after the Canadian Parliament voted to uphold unprecedented use of the Emergencies Act, Prime Minister Justin Castro Trudeau, okay, Castro's my word, I'm sorry, Justin Trudeau announced in a press conference on Wednesday afternoon that he has revoked the measure completely. Look how power he has. This is what happens when you have a democracy. It turns into a dictatorship. The Prime Minister, the Prime Minister puts on the Emergencies Act, the Prime Minister takes off the Emergencies Act, and everybody follows along. You know, it's like one day there's no emergency, the next day there is an emergency, let's put the Emergencies Act on, and everybody dutifully, beats up people in the streets, and the police beat up people and arrest all kinds of people and do all the things that police do when it becomes a martial law situation, and then they go back to being, nice, friendly, officer friendly. Okay, and then the Trudeau says, okay, revoke the emergency powers, they don't exist anymore, so let's get back to normal. And then the police go back to being, Adam 12. So it is a fascinating transference how easy it is to turn police into stormtroopers and then back into police again, unless they always had that kind of stormtrooper tendency. Some of them, the ones that stay, and do that kind of stuff. Not all police did this. I heard half the Ottawa police resigned over this, and that's not a big story. I can confirm that. I'm going to look into that, but that's what I've heard. Anyway, article says the sudden decision to give up his emergency powers, which were set to remain for at least the next 3 weeks, is an unexpected one, to say the least. After all, Trudeau has employed the Emergencies Act for the past 10 days and has utilized the near limitless power to terrorize and harass the grassroots trucker convoy protests. So it's not like he had a sudden change of heart. However, the article continues, Trudeau now says that the emergency is over. So what changed over the past 48 hours? Trudeau announced the decision. It says, we're ready to confirm the situation is no longer an emergency. Therefore, the federal government will be ending the use of the Emergencies Act. We are confident that existing laws and bylaws are now sufficient to keep people safe. Yeah, except from the government, of course. I mean, the problem, that's the whole reason for the protests in the first place, is that the government is making people anything but safe. Anyway, and it says safe, of course, and back to Trudeau's statement. He says, we will continue to be there to support provincial and local authorities if and when needed. So the oppression is always there if it has to come back. Anyway, update. According to reports, back to Gateway Pundit, Trudeau did not have enough support to uphold his use of the Emergencies Act in the Senate, which was set to vote on the matter tonight. That would be the 23rd. So apparently, in order to save himself the embarrassment, Trudeau caved in and announced he was revoking the act. Even one of Trudeau's handpicked senators, Pierre Dalfond, turned on him early today, saying he would not vote for the act over concerns of how Trudeau was abusing his near limitless powers to violate citizens' charter rights. That's interesting. You know, I have to send this to Jen Clark in Australia, because one of the things that I found from the information she gave me talking about rights is that when they talk about charter rights, this is really key. And this goes to understanding what rights are. And the way I understand them, rights are God-given. They are your birthright. You own them, your rights. Now, whether you exercise them or not, it's up to you. Okay, but you own your rights. Government cannot touch your rights. Rights are the point at which government power ends. And to remind governments where their power ends, we write those rights down into a Bill of Rights, an enumerated series of rights, which is not exclusive. It's not limiting. You know, it would be impossible to define all the rights, all the freedoms, all the things that people can exercise in order to maintain a state of liberty. So you list the as much as you can, as simply as you can, as straightforwardly as you can, as a limitation on government to show them what they can't do. And sometimes it has to be enforced. You know, if the executive goes after people of the courts, their job is to stop the executive from doing what they want to do that exceeds and infringes on people's individual rights. You know, when the courts exceed their powers and suppress rights, then it's up to the Congress or the legislature or the parliament, you know, in the case of Canada and Australia, to remove those judges for exceeding their power. Okay, so that's how it works. So the checks and balances all around. And so the Bill of Rights, a Bill of Rights is actually owned by the people, ideally written by the people, and sent to government for their ratification through the federal process, the state process, a popular vote of the people, any combination of the above. Australia has a combination. It's kind of interesting. But here's the problem. And whenever they talk about a charter rights, where the charter really is the UN Declaration of Human Rights. So in other words, the UN has infiltrated constitutions all over the world where they've adopted the language. I saw it in the New Zealand Constitution. It's probably in the Canadian. I haven't checked yet. I'm going to. I know it's in the Australian Constitution, and it's in the Australian proposal for a Bill of Rights. Is the UN Declaration on Human Rights, which says that all rights apply to everybody, and everybody has a right to a whole bunch of stuff, you know, food, shelter, education, you know, money, sustainable incomes, sustainable development, a bunch of other things in the UN Globalist Socialist World Program. And so to adopt the UN program under a charter is to basically eliminate your individual rights, because nowhere does the word individual connect to rights in anything that the UN says. It's all group. Well, they occasionally mention, you know, rights, and they say they're individual, but you really those under the guise of what they then call responsibilities. So in other words, they'll list an individual right and then say, well, that right comes with a responsibility. Well, responsibility to who? Well, to everybody else. Well, if the exercise of your rights is dependent on your responsibility to everybody else, then you have no rights, because then the government can enforce, you know, the oppression of your rights under the guise of, well, you're not being responsible, okay? You're being unfair, you know, you're not being equitable. You're casting aspersions. You're offending people, okay? So rights, the responsibility of rights, it comes in the exercise. All right. And the clearest example I can give is firearms. You have and rights are, you know, I always say that rights are absolute within the context of the right. So the right you have is like with firearms. You have a right to own and carry firearms, to keep and bear under the United States Constitution. That's what it says. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Okay. So it's a limitation on government from infringing on your natural right, your God-given right to keep and bear or own and carry arms. Okay. Now, should you use those arms in a fashion that is illegal, you know, murder, carjacking, theft, robbery, assault, you know, threatening folks, extortion, blackmail, you know, whatever you use it for, brandishing, all the way down to, so from murder to brandishing, all the things that are illegally done with firearms, mass murder, gang killings, you know, things like that, all that stuff is illegal, okay? Now, just because you have a right to keep and bear arms, does that give you permission to use them in a fashion that is illegal? No, it doesn't. Okay, so where the right ends, you're using that the right that you were given, you know, use it for a purpose that is otherwise illegal. Now, does that mean that in the same way, and people can say, well, wait a minute, if you can stop people from murdering other people, you know, with guns, then can't you stop people from offending people with speech? No, because they're two different things. And this is where it gets messy. Right? It's hard to walk into this, but there's no right not to be offended. So if you define rights in terms of responsibility to the feelings or perceptions of others, then you have no right of free speech. Because free speech, you know, the whole right of free speech is to protect the most offensive, most, you know, controversial speech possible. That's why you have it. You know, if speech were friendly and everybody agreed with it, it wouldn't be free. It'd be conditioned on everybody agreeing with it. Okay, so that doesn't work. Anyway, so this is where these things get messy. So a charter, the two things we're talking about, one is a charter of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which basically has universal group rights run by a world government. That's what they're talking about. But if you look at the simple word charter, what is a charter? Okay, a charter is what a bank or a corporation gets in order to operate. In other words, it's government permission. So the biggest problem is whenever you base your rights on government permission, they're not rights at all either, because what the government giveth, the government can taketh away. Okay, so if a bank gets a charter from the government to operate, and then they get their rules, they get their restrictions, they get their operating procedures, and they violate that, then the charter gets revoked and the bank goes out of business because they can't operate because they don't have a charter. They don't have government permission to operate. Well, the whole point of rights is you don't need government permission to operate. Government needs your permission to operate, you know, and they do it within the framework that doesn't touch your rights. That's their permission. So in other words, it's from the people to the government, not from government to the people. So rights do not come from government to the people. Rights are born with the people, and people use rights, the exercise of rights, and people declare rights to limit the powers of government to touch them. There's a separation. There's a complete separation between rights and government powers. Otherwise, rights don't exist. If you know, and I don't know how else to make that any clearer, but that's what it is. Anyway, so that's the story from Gateway Pundit. And so I do get a little discretion, a little discussion there. So we've got Shirley coming on just a little bit. Let me play you a Santa Rosa Volunteer piece for you real quickly while I can squeak this in. And then we'll get to Shirley. And then Jim Dykes at the top of the hour. You know, let's see what I can play. I haven't played for a while. No, in fact, I think she's here right now, so I might just bring her on early. Yeah, I see. Yeah, I'll just do one thing real quickly here. I'm cutting and pasting. And I don't have Shirley's theme yet. I should. It'd be much, much better. Now let's put this here. Let's do this here. Live radio, don't mind me. All right, so I'll get to those things. Actually, I'm going to have a break in an hour because Derek's not going to be here. And Derek's our financial person. I really wish he was here because it'd be so much more fun to talk to him you know, about all the stuff that's going on. Because while you're being distracted with Ukraine, while you're being distracted with Brandon, while Brandon gives the sorry State of the Union speech on Tuesday, the real situation is getting, you know, continually worse. And, of course, the trucker convoy is heading to Washington, too. So there's a whole lot going on. So let's bring on Shirley Wachtel. Let me get a round of applause for her real quickly here because I don't have her theme yet. I will. It's been busy. I've been fixing my website. You know, things have been crazy. So let's do this. Good morning, Shirley.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Well, a bit frustrated. We had a problem with our website, and so I'm having to restore, get the files back, do all kinds of other things to it, and so it's taking a while. So that's why I mentioned of it earlier, because that website's critical to the trucker convoy, and it's critical to Action Radio too, because that's where the links to the bills go to the actual bills themselves, and without the website, there's nowhere to go. And so that's a problem. So I'm kind of a little upset, you know, spent a whole lot of time doing things that I didn't want to do because there's so much else that I have to work on, including working with Jen Clark in Australia on their Australian Bill of Rights. And it's fascinating the different views that she has and that I have of rights. I mean, we're very much on a different place because of, you know, the whole idea of a Commonwealth, of Parliament, of the way that, you know, people, most of the world looks at rights in terms of what the government allows you to do. We look at rights as what we can do that we prohibit the government from touching. And that fundamental difference creates very interesting discussions as we try to work out for Australia something that Jen can present to everybody else. So that's another interesting thing. So
their rights, go ahead. Are more like privileges because the government gives them?
In a way, yeah. Well, you've got your line's a bit distorted. I'm not sure what's going on. We'll see if we can fix that up a little bit. I don't know if you're in a bad place, if you're moving, but we'll get that corrected. The rights, what's interesting is that the UN Charter of Human Rights, the UN Declaration on Human Rights, has pervaded both the New Zealand and the Australian constitutions in the fact that the last proposed Australian Bill of Rights in 2019 was almost verbatim the UN Declaration of Human Rights. And the problem is they think of rights in Australia, and I saw a video, we talked about this with Jen yesterday, Jen Clark, who's one of the leaders of the trucker convoy. We talked about the fact that people oppose a Bill of Rights because they think it gives, you know, the judges too much power and the people, you know, really shouldn't have, don't need a declared Bill of Rights. It was fascinating. But they talk about rights in terms of a charter. And I was just talking about this a couple of minutes ago. Well, a charter, like a bank charter, is a permission slip. So in other words, you know, you have, like in California, the concealed carry permits on a may-issue basis. So in other words, the government may give you permission to carry a gun, or it may not, even though the Second Amendment clearly says the government can't touch your right to carry a gun. So most of the world looks upon them as government rights. They say they're rights, but what they really are is sort of a statement that, you know, we really don't want you to touch this government, but they still think of rights in terms of government given as opposed to God given. And that fundamental difference in the orientation of rights is something I'm really starting to learn about now. So that's where we are.
Well, that's a mouthful, isn't it? Is this better? I tried to use a different headset. So can you hear me now?
Yep, huh. Much better. Now, if you have a headset and a microphone, I can send you.
Not a fancy one, just like earbuds with a. Oh, okay. I was trying that, but.
Well, if you ever get, we use like the Yeti Blue microphone, which we plug directly in the computer. Jim's got one. And so once you figure out the gain, you got to turn the gain way down because the mics are much more powerful than the computer. But I can send you what's called a direct connect invitation. And you just plug that in and you'll talk to me directly through your computer over the internet as opposed to over a phone line. And so it's much less subject to interference. So that kind of works out.
Oh,
that's a cool thing too. Yeah,
okay.
But your phone's fine. This is working great. So do you want to weigh in on the rights battle? I don't know if you've been following our story with Jen or do you want to go to your report? Always give you the option.
No, I haven't had a chance to. I was wanting to listen to it, but I was not able to. It's been a little crazy. Last weekend I was at Bama Carey doing a.
Ooh, what's that?
I was one of the speakers there.
Oh, wow. Do we have
awesome.
Your video? Do you have a video of your speech?
They did take one. I haven't found it yet. They said they were going to post it, so I'll check into that.
Yeah,
but,
put it in the gun group.
It was awesome. It was quite an experience. Those people are really pretty cool, especially since they can open carry. that was nice. It was like,
gee, wouldn't it be nice
if
we had that in Florida?
I check into the hotel and then I see four or five guys over by the lobby on one of these tables and I went, look at that. They're all open carrying. I bet they're part of Bama Carry.
Or they just could have been just guys at the hotel. Yeah. Or what were they? Were they just guys at the hotel or what?
No.
Yeah.
No, they were part of the board for a Bama Carry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you see women openly carrying? Were there women normal occupation street, you know, walking around doing their, you know, what, you know, commerce and things and, you know?
No, I mean, I didn't get to do a whole lot of that. I mean, I showed up on a Friday and I was supposed to leave Sunday, but due to airplane problems, I wasn't able to get out of Alabama Monday.
Mm. Wow.
At the event, there men and women were open carrying, but the only other place I was at was at the airport and then the hotel they put me up at. Most of them, I'm going to guess, were just guests. So, no, they didn't open carry.
Well, you can't fly in with a gun easily. I mean, you can, but it's a pain to do so.
Well, yeah.
Unless, of course, you work for the government.
The thing that concerned me, because I used to, did that for 3-gun and everything, but two people have told me probably in the past year and a half, that even though they had their pistols locked up properly in their suitcase, they were gone. They disappeared.
Were they still putting firearm stickers on to identify the fact that there was a gun in the case? I know they were doing that for a while.
But a pistol, they you put it in your regular suitcase that you check in.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, you have to open it, and I don't think you are. Well, I don't know in that case. I know 3-gun because you have a separate case. They have to hand deliver it to you. I don't know if they hand deliver it to you if it's in your regular luggage or not.
Mm.
I don't know that answer. But, they did disappear. And these are people I know, so it's not like hearsay on Facebook.
Oh, no, I've
There's
heard this
no
before, too, but they used to. I've heard this, but I don't know if they still do it, but they used to put firearm stickers, in other words, to identify, well, we have to keep this safe. Let's put a firearm sticker. And, of course, all the baggage handlers know where the guns are. You might as well say, steal me. You know, I don't think they do that anymore because of the thefts, but even so. Yeah, guns are hot property, and you're responsible, and they're, you know, or if you lose it, it's like, you know, then you got to report it and you got to do all this other kind of crap. That's not a good situation.
Yeah. One time, because, you know, a three-gun case is huge. You get your rifle, pistol, and shotgun all in one big case. So mm-hmm. It's totally separate. You don't have any of your private stuff in there, your personal stuff. One time
right.
I'm standing because you got to go this certain place, and they hand deliver it to you. And I'm waiting, and everybody's picked up all their luggage. And I'm like, where the heck is it? And nobody's around to ask. And I just happened to walk over to the little carousel, and there it is, mm-hmm. spinning around. And I went, oh, my gosh, you put it in the regular baggage. But it
yeah.
was still there, thank God.
Well, good. Well, it didn't have a big firearm sticker on it, and nobody knew what it was. Otherwise, somebody would have picked it up and walked off with it, yeah.
Yeah, that's,
never know.
That's one of the reasons I don't put firearm stickers on it, even though most people probably would figure it out. They might think it's a guitar or something, but who knows?
Yeah. Well, it's a shaped gun. Well, that's a good point. Are there gun cases shaped like guitar cases?
Actually,
there is one.
I did see it on Facebook, I think it was, and
uh-huh.
it's for a rifle. It only fits one firearm, but it was shaped like that. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. You only had one to transport, and you didn't want anybody to know what was in it.
That's funny. Well, good case is big enough. You could put a long rifle, you know, in the center of it, and you could put maybe, if you had a takedown, you know, a smaller shotgun, and then put it like a handgun
yeah.
above it. You could make a three-gun case out of a guitar case pretty easily.
Yeah, wasn't it? Didn't they have like violin cases or something in the old days? They come in with
the old days.
Guns.
Yeah, the old days. Yeah, before both of our time. Yeah, it's kind of fun. All right, folks, I'm not that old. All right, jeez. But they used to keep. They have a violin case because you could put your 100-round drum in your Tommy. Well, I don't know how they did that exactly, but or maybe the straight magazine. But yeah, they would put guns in different cases. You know, just kind of walk down the street,
yeah.
or they, you know, they'll play you a tune on my violin. They'll give you like the
yeah.
Brooklyn, you know. Hey, okay, look, this is what we're gonna do. I can play you a tune on my violin. Like, you got it? Hey, what's your problem? Anyway. Yeah, crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Huh? So, what'd you speak about?
I spoke on domestic violence.
Okay.
Kind of like, you know, it's kind of like that elephant in the middle of the room. Nobody really talks about it, but it's happening all over the world, nationwide, and all different
wow.
continents. And, you know, it has no boundaries. Doesn't care how much money you make, doesn't care what sex you are, what race you are, what religion you are. It's just out there. And we talked about that and the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence and how their statistics show that 1 in 4 women will be severely abused at some point in their life by an intimate partner.
Wow.
And we talked a lot about that. Because not everybody might know, not all the listeners might know, I am a survivor of domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what happened is, and why I'm now such an advocate for the Second Amendment is because when I went out and practiced my right to the Second Amendment and learned how to handle a firearm safely, all of a sudden I started to change and became a more independent, courageous, and my self-esteem just started soaring, and I've been going on that route ever since. The more I learn, the more confident I get, and so I just wanted to share that with women and men. And a lot of the women came up, and I was selling. I do have a book out called Heels to Holster.
Mm-hmm.
And
you should mention
that
every show, by the way. Don't be afraid to mention that every show and where to find it too. I mean, this is part of the deal. If you're going to come on my show and give a report, you get to name your accomplishments. So feel free.
It's still unbelievable. And I always like, oh yeah, I did write a book, but you can get it on Amazon. It's called Heels to Holster. And I take you on the journey. I relive the journey of surviving that domestic violence. I mean, I basically was held hostage for 15 hours, and then
wow.
after I did get released and did the things that I thought I should do to legally protect myself, you know, those restraining orders, which are, we've talked about those before, are just a piece of
mm-hmm.
paper,
yeah.
and also the gated communities, which are also a false sense of security. And after starting doing things like that, and I thought, oh, I'm going to be safe, everything's going back to normal, well, things escalated, and it turned into a life-threatening situation.
Wow.
And, so I know that to get where I am today, it's, you know, by the grace of God, I'm alive today, because it's only because the form of how he wanted to kill me, he actually got in contact with an informant who was working with the law enforcement. Other than if that wasn't the case, I probably wouldn't be here today. So, you know, I share that just like I said, because I know there's a lot of other women out there that are in the same situation. Even though you're a survivor, you're really not living life. You're just kind of going through the motions because, you know, when you've gone through some fearful or life-threatening situation, it kind of changes you. And what brought me back was my first firearms class. So if anyone's interested in getting the book, it is available on Amazon. It's called Heels to Holster. And like I said, the more importantly, like I knew I had to, now I can look back and say I had to go through it to get where I am today. I wouldn't be in this field as a firearms instructor. I wouldn't be sharing my story to help other women. And it's been a journey, exciting one. And I wouldn't be here on the show. So, yay.
Yeah. Well, you might be, but it'd be a different context. But what you've done, I think, is the healthiest reaction to a terrible situation. And so anybody that's suffered traumatic experiences, you know, I call my childhood pretty, you know, so like a never-ending series of traumas. I was never hurt physically. I was never, you know, deprived of, you know, like food, shelter, things like that. It was all mental. It was all mental, emotional, you know, brainwashing, basically. But surviving that and, you know, coming out perfectly healthy, you know, physically, and then mentally being a total basket case to sort of go, well, what the hell happened? How come I don't think like everybody else? What's going on here? Process. You learn, for me, you know, I learned about my past. I learned a whole bunch of psychology. I learned to do a ton of research. And that set me free. And so now I can do action radio. This set you free, being able to help other women, being able to realize your own potential and your own self-worth. And to not ever, to know that you're never going to feel that that low of self-esteem or be in a position emotionally where anybody's going to be able to touch you again. I mean, you know, I know you know, you know, and so that's a good thing. So that's the healthiest reaction. My concern is for the people that have the opposite reaction, that withdraw, that feel completely, you know, disempowered, that go to alcohol or antidepressants, or that they don't meet the challenge of what happened, the trauma of what happened, and put it in perspective, and then find something to resolve it and you know, carry on from that to do something better. Like, you know, I was always told, you know, all the things I couldn't do when I grew up. And so now I try to talk to young people about, you know, don't worry about what people tell you you can't do. What do you want to do? You know, where are you going to go? What adventure are you going to have? And they look at me like I'm some kind of alien. I said, oh, okay, all right, we need to chat, you know. And so that's my way of kind of giving back for opportunities I've lost, you know. So every, you know, what you're doing is wonderful, and it's you know, you honor God, you honor yourself, you honor, you know, your all the fellow humans you come in contact with, and you're doing some really good work. And I think, you know, like I say, you can turn a tragedy into something positive. And anybody that you save from a similar situation is worth every bit of it, I think. And so, yeah, keep doing what you're doing. Pat yourself on the back.
Oh. Well, yeah, and then, like I said, now I am I'm the Florida State Director for DC Project, which is Women for Gun Rights. You know, we're out there defending and fighting for our Second Amendment rights to hold on to them. And they had some really good speakers at Bama Cary. Eric Pratt, Senior Vice President of Gun Owners of America.
Oh, did you make contact with him? Did you? Are you able to bring him on the show?
Well, I do know him, made contact. I made contact with him before. Actually, I gave him my book before.
Okay.
But I'm trying to keep it into the women's world because I'm kind of like the, you know, guns and women. I had thought about that, but, you know, I might just go ahead and throw him in there. But he wrote this book called, and I have a copy of it, Firing Back, which I haven't read through the whole thing. I started reading it. And it's basically how to counter anti-gun propaganda and become a better two-way activist. So it's been really, really educational how to deal with the gun control folks, you know, and how you know, not to get them to be too aggressive, but, you know, you want to make change. How do you want to make change? Is that gun control going to stop that person from doing that mass murder? I mean, they already broke the law, so how's that? How's another law going to make a difference? And it points stuff out like that. He also brought up, in his when he spoke, the ATF, how it admits it has nearly a billion gun records of gun owners and what kind of guns they own.
Yeah, let me talk about that for a second, because I think it's really important. Mm-hmm. I've always thought that the FBI, you know, as soon as they had those instant checks, I said, wait a minute, you know, several years ago, I said, that's going to become a registry. You know, oh, no, it's not. They're going to destroy the records. I said, are you kidding? When does government ever destroy records of people once they have them? You know, it was always, I think it was always planned to be a registry of gun owners. I think it was, you know, and registry leads to confiscation. That's why they do it. And so I think this has long been the issue. And the whole idea, this is why I proposed. In fact, I actually had Larry Pratt, Eric's father, on the show back at WEBY before he, just about right before he retired from running Gun Owners of America. And I told him of a bill that I wrote, which reverses this. So in other words, the prohibited people are on the list. You don't check everybody, because that way you can register everybody, which is exactly what the ATF has done. But if you just have the prohibited people, which the state is responsible for, you know, maintaining their list, available to, you know, federal firearms licensed people. I mean, they're already accountable to the government. And then if you put, you know, the name and a photo ID with, you know, of the prohibited folks, then anybody presenting their photo ID and name, you know, can be held up to the screen. And say, well, that's not you. You're good. You know, and that is a background check, you know, and that wouldn't register anybody.
Yeah.
And it's nobody would know, because it would be just a private transaction. Then you worry about that form 4473 or whatever it is. But there are ways to check without registering. And that's the problem with that thing. But
then
they were saying
were saying, I guess they were not digitized, but now 94% of them are digitized.
Hmm.
So yeah, it's growing into basically a registry. You're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. So the answer for me is to remove the ATF, to abolish the ATF and destroy all the records. We don't need an ATF,
yeah.
I think. Okay.
Yeah, no, you're backed by a lot of other people that have that same opinion, as I've learned as I'm talking to other folks as well.
Hmm.
But yeah, if you're, and the other thing that we're talking about being a really good 2A activist and advocate, this weekend I'm going to be going to West Orlando Firearms Training Facility, and they're having their Ambassador Academy. I've gone to a couple of them in the past, and I'm helping out this year. And that's put on by Diana Mueller.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we had her on the air before.
Yeah,
and
she's great.
Basically, it's kind of like a boot camp. I describe it as a boot camp for social media and interaction with reporters. You get to practice how you interact with a reporter who may be a hostile reporter. And talking about Second Amendment, or you might be on a radio show where, you know, it's a friendly environment and they're telling your story. So you practice these different things like that. And then social media, how they program it so certain things come out, and their algorithms, how they're used and, you know, stuff like that, and how to post and how to make videos with music and stuff like that. It's awesome, but it's like full force 5 days of information, and it's great. So I'm looking forward to going up there and helping with that.
Lobbyist training. I love it. Yeah.
Basically, yeah, and it works really well. It started out, it's gone to the Second Amendment, but it also is if you're a sponsored shooter or if you're sponsored by somebody, it's how to be a good sponsee and get a return on their investment, how to help them out, how to get information about whatever product you're using of theirs.
Yeah. Whenever
and advertise
I talk
it
to folks,
on social media.
Yeah. Yes. It's interesting. I've worked with gun, you know, pro gun arguments and pro rights arguments, for years. Actually, I made a video several years ago. I was trying to make these half-hour news broadcasts to simulate news ones. And I actually made about an hour and a half gun special with all kinds of stuff going into projection, why gun phobes exist. And what I do is I change the language. I change the language on them. I don't use their terminology. I try never to use the term gun control because it's too effective. We need an equivalent term that is just as simple, just as straightforward, that totally that, you know, eliminates that use. It's like you'll never hear me say assault weapon. It's always freedom rifle. You know, so the first thing I do is change the language. And in changing the language, you change the debate. You know, and when someone says, why do you need an assault weapon? Okay. Well, you know, why? First of all, it's a freedom rifle, and the answer to your question is, you know, for my freedom. And then you say, well, why do you need to know? Why do you need control over my rights? What are you worried about? What's the issue? You know, and then I always turn the questions around to them, to the person that's, you know, questions I think are your most effective response whenever someone's, you know, asking you all kinds of things that are guaranteed to elicit a specific response. That's why they ask them, you know, what do you think of gun control? Well, I think it's misnamed. I mean, freak people out, come at them in a direction that they don't expect, you know, and I think it makes for a much stronger argument. Go ahead.
One of the theories I'm going to work on, because there's a couple of different books that cover it, are the language that is used by the media and how it brainwashes not only the regular folks, but also the Second Amendment activists. You're using those words, but they're used so often in a negative form that as soon as you say them, they come up in that form in your head. Mm-hmm. So I was going to be putting something together on that, because that's also covered in Eric's book, as well as Dan Wath, Good Gun, Bad Guy, Good Gun, Good Gun, Bad Guy.
Yeah,
he covers it really well, too.
Yeah. It's like using the term gun violence. So it's not gun violence. It's criminal violence.
Exactly. You know, I mean, exactly.
So you take the gun out of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's, well, the left does this all the time. It's a fascinating study in leftist propaganda. You know, when they talk about illegal immigrants. You know, well, there's no such thing as an illegal immigrant. You're either an illegal alien or a legal immigrant. Immigrant, by definition, is somebody who's in the country legally. You can't have an illegal immigrant. That's irrational. Yeah. So all these things.
Exactly.
There's so many ways.
You pointed that out to me, and I kept saying it, and I'm like, oh my gosh, you're absolutely right. Things that we're so programmed because we hear it in the media so much that it just comes out of our mouth. So So we got to talk to change the way we converse and talk, and you know, our vocabulary a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, and I'd like to find another. I mean, gun control is such an effective term. That's why it's still in use. You know, if someone asks me if I'm in favor of gun control, and I say, "Well, I'm against gun phobes telling me what to do with my rights," I mean, don't even answer the question. Totally turn it around. You know, Well, thank you. I got them in this article. You know, I do things like, you know, when there was a big controversy over the minimum wage, and of course, conservatives are always asked, what do you think of the minimum wage? And the way that you answer that, the fact that the liberal asked it, you're going to lose, because no matter what you say, you're going to be branded as a conservative that hates people. Okay. So what I did is I wrote an article I created a whole new term, the total revenue index. And so when someone says, well, are you for or against the minimum wage? Well, I said, my first response is, well, that's only part of the question. So the real question is, how much are people getting? So if somebody's working for a minimum wage and they're getting Section 8 housing benefits and they're getting welfare and they're getting cash and they're getting food stamps, you know, and they're getting all these different benefits, how much are they really getting? If they're being, especially if they get stimulus payments not to work. So, and then I went, actually the Cato Institute did a really good thing on this. And what they showed is that if you take the total amount people get, which I call the total revenue index, and you include the minimum wage plus all this other stuff, in Hawaii, it works, at least it worked out to this several years ago when I wrote the article, about $50 to $75 an hour, if you break it down to hourly wage. So if you're talking about the total, it's really interesting. And Mississippi is one of the lowest places, you know, but the cost of living is low there too. Hawaii is a high cost of living. So if you look at the total revenue, and here's a new way to answer it. Are you for or against the minimum wage? Well, let's take a look at the total revenue index. How much are people actually making? And if you do that, as opposed to working, people on welfare are actually making more than people who are working. So then the answer to the question is, I'm against people making more money from my taxes than I'm making from working and being productive. So that's my answer to the question, what do I think of the minimum wage? Totally different argument, totally changed around, reversed, and put on them to now justify. So then you ask them, well, how can you justify people making more money on a total revenue index than they make from working? Now you've won. And that's how the gun argument should go too. New terms, new ideas, new concepts, reverse the argument, put it on them, ask them the question. That's how I do it, or at least I try to.
No, that's basically one of the points that Eric was making. He kind of turns on them, you know, the mass killings out there, you know, they happen. So what gun control, you know, what would have prevented that from happening? Give me one. And
well,
there isn't one, because the person that did it was a criminal. Their intent was to break the law anyway. And so they're still going to break the law. So there's really no gun control or gun laws that are going to prevent that from happening if they're a criminal at heart.
Yeah, you can't make a law that'll stop people who are automatically predisposed to breaking the law. You know,
and that summed it up perfect.
Oh, thank you. See, well, get it on the podcast because I just come out with these. I just come out with these things. So get it on the podcast. But yeah, well, let me see if I can. You cannot make a law. You cannot make an effective law against people who are already predisposed to breaking the law. Yeah, so I think that pretty much sums it up. The other thing too is that you cannot stop criminals by disarming the law abiding. That's another, and you've probably heard that one before.
Yeah.
You can't stop criminals. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, and I use my favorite analogy is the bank. Okay, you know, you can't stop bank robbers by removing the depositors. You know, and that's such an absurd example. But you think about it.
Yeah.
You know, are you going to stop bank robbery by getting rid of all the customers? Well, no. You know, because the customers are doing things that are illegal. Yeah, it's still, the bank robber is still going to rob. They're just going to, you know, and that's the same thing. So you can't stop crime by disarming the victims.
That's
you know, and these little catchphrases are perfect. Well, anyway, in the few minutes we have left, were there other women that spoke that had some new ideas and interesting things?
Yes, Beth Alcazar.
Who's that?
She's with USCCA. She's written a few books. She's an awesome lady. She's with CC Project as well. She's the Alabama State Director. I'm gonna see if I can get her on the show sometime. And USCCA is basically, for anyone that does not know, is an insurance policy for anyone that conceals carry. In case you have to defend yourself, you know, you always need to have someone on your side that provides you with an attorney and information as to help you through the legal. And
I'll need that once I get my first million listeners and, you know, have a huge amount of money and then can buy my jet. but seriously though, that is definitely a very valuable thing in a society that, you know, government doesn't want people armed. They want to have all the guns so that they can have all the power. You know, and we know that they don't disarm the criminals because the criminals are used to, you know, make the people fearful so they'll run to government. I mean, criminals are basically an arm of government, which is why they defend them. It's kind of interesting. Anyway, I'm sorry. You were saying.
And they had amazing speakers. One other woman was Chris Ann Hall from Tampa.
Oh, I know her. She's been on the show. She's been on the show.
Isn't she
Chris Ann Hall's
amazing?
Wonderful.
She's like a little, she got me all fired up, and I'm like, oh, I got to get into her classes, and she just knows the Constitution, everything about. Oh, she's just great. She's just awesome.
Yep. I've been in touch with her. I want
to
get her hopefully to take a look at some of the bills they're doing, particularly the gun bills and some of the other bills. And DC Project would be, I'd love to have their endorsement as well on some of our program provisions like tax credits and tax deductions and, you know, using suppressors for home defense so you don't go deaf when you save your life and some of the other things and the background check, you know, based on the prohibited list only. You know, if you can take a look through the gun bills and see if DC Project or you as Florida director and the Alabama director, you know, maybe you can endorse these and incorporate them into the speeches in these conferences because everybody complains about the problems, but we've got solutions here. We've got real solutions, real gun bills that could be very effective if promoted. You know, and I'm hoping that the reason that I did this is to hopefully that'll transfer into the conferences and into the debates and into the media and eventually into the legislatures. So we can make these things a reality.
Right. Yeah. It was awesome.
Okay.
A bunch of good stuff.
Oh, yeah.
A bunch of good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim's on the line now, so you got a couple more minutes, or do you have to go at the top of the hour?
Well, I'm going to try and listen, but I do have to go. I have to go teach class. I also have some construction people waiting to come into my house to do some work. So I'm kind of like juggling all these plates in the air, but I really want to hear what Jim has to say and how we're doing on anything with it. Oh, the other thing, real quick, Alabama, I'm sure Jim probably already heard, he'll probably talk about that. Constitutional carry in Alabama passed the House Tuesday. Yeah. So I want to thank you very much for my time. I will try and listen in. And if anyone's interested, any ladies are interested in joining DC Project and continuing to fight for a Second Amendment, you can go to dcproject.info. Anyone interested in purchasing my book, Heels to Holster, you can find that on Amazon.com. And that's it. And thank you very much. And
well, nice to talk to Jim's
on.
Live if you want to
radio.
Say hi. Yeah. No, I appreciate it. Jim's live if you want to say hi. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Jim. How you doing?
Good morning.
And I will actually give a plug for Heels to Holster. Great book.
Okay.
Bought it and read it. Great book for anyone who's interested in the Second Amendment to read, and anyone who's interested in women empowering themselves.
Thank you very much for that.
Sounds good to me. All right. Thank you, Shirley. Hopefully, yeah, like I said, you can listen in. If not, you can always catch the podcast 24/7, 365 days a year. We are here. All right. Let's get Jim's theme, and away we go.
Out of the forests of Virginia to the swamps of southern Florida comes a great man who carries a big gun, probably a Desert Eagle 50 caliber. He served our nation in the military. He protected the citizenry in law enforcement. And now he is a director of Florida Carry, trying to make the Second Amendment, as written, a reality for all Americans. He is Jim Dykes with the Second Amendment Report for Action Radio.
So Alabama's going to get concealed carrying. Open carrying. We don't have it.
What's going on, Jim? Alabama already has open carry.
Alabama has open carry. That's right. Arkansas.
Yeah.
What's the other state she mentioned?
So Alabama is on its way to constitutional carry, we hope.
Okay.
So the constitutional carry bill passed the Alabama House, as Shirley said, this week on Tuesday. And so I'm cautiously optimistic that Alabama will soon join the list of constitutional carry states and continue to show why we need to do something to put better Republicans in office in Florida, because there's no reason Florida should not join that list as well.
Oh, it's crazy. We should have been the first. Right after Shall Issue, we should have had, no issue. Let's go right for constitutional carry. You know, and that's a sad thing. That's a sad comment on the geldings, the GOP geldings, that there are two Republican parties, you know, the real one and, that we the people, you know, represent, and then the geldings that are actually running the party, which is too bad. There's a Senate majority right now. I mean, the Republican Senate is 50 Republicans to 49 Democrats, and actually 47 if you don't count the two independents caucusing, you know, with the Democrats. And we've talked about that. There could be a rule change. And I know it's temporary. I know Senator Lujan's going to be back, and God bless him. You know, I wish him a speedy recovery. But the political reality is they've got a majority right now, and they've done absolutely nothing with it. So I don't hold too much faith in Republicans at any stage along the way. Unless you get a huge amount of you need to change what, maybe 2/3 of the party overturn before you can have a decent, opposition party to the Democrat folks that are basically running things still, even though they have a minority in the Senate. That's scary.
I actually don't know that you even need to get 2/3 of the party. All you really need to do is get the leadership and the big money donors, because I will tell you the vast majority of the Republicans who are in office claim to have very strong moral constitutional feelings that they will always uphold. But the fact is most of them only care about being reelected and staying in office. And if you have leadership and donors who are pushing them to do the right thing and to act constitutionally, they will do that simply for fear of losing their seat.
Yep. No, I agree with you. I think you're right on. I mean, you're the practical reality to my, you know, boundless optimism. it's really nice to see that. That's very important.
In your defense, I had boundless optimism as well until I got really involved with Florida Carry and spent some time in Tallahassee and saw how things actually work in the political process.
I understand. That's why I created Action Radio. So that we are the political process. That's the whole idea of it. That's why I'm so excited to be writing a Bill of Rights working with Jen Clark in Australia, and making the distinction between a charter of rights from the government, permission from the government, you know, the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which seems to pervade everybody's constitution now, I'm finding out, and as opposed to an actual Bill of Rights from we the people that limits government, says you can't go here, you can't cross this line, these are my rights. You know, and it's a very interesting process. Shirley's back with us. So, Shirley, if you want to join in, feel free. Or if you just want to listen in, that's okay, too. But we got her on the line here, and I've made it live. Speaking of the geldings, and I know you got a bunch of topics, we've got a little extra time if you have it, because Derek is still out this week as well. But I'm still waiting for a major resolution in Congress, condemning what happened in Canada. I know the Trudeau's rescinded
his emergency powers. But the fact that he had them at all should have caused the geldings, if they were any kind of, you know, leaders, to immediately condemn that, have a resolution, even if it didn't pass. They should have proposed it, or the state legislatures. And I can't think of a single instance. I could be wrong, but I can't think of a single instance where anybody, any legislative body of Republicans, stood up and said what Canada did was wrong. Individually, they did, but there wasn't any resolution. There was no official action. Am I right in that, or do you know of something that was actually done?
To the best of my knowledge, that is correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think that people who really care about freedom and liberty within the Republican Party should be standing up and at least trying to pass a resolution.
Yeah. I mean, I don't care if it doesn't pass, you know, because I know it's not going to pass. I know it's not going to pass because the geldings are still letting the Democrats run the Senate, even though they have a majority. And the majority in the House, you know, there's basically one vote in the House. Nancy Pelosi has the vote. What she says goes, because she controls all the Democrats, controls all the committee chairs, controls all the money for their campaigns, controls everything. So there is no representative government in the House. The Speaker has all the power because of parties. And so you're not going to get anything out of the House with the Democrats in charge. When the Republicans are in charge, they put Paul Ryans, they put rhinos up there who basically kowtow to the Democrats because they want good positions in media later. It seems to be how it works. So that's not any good. So there is no opposition party. There's nobody to stand up for our rights. That's why we have to do it. It's a fascinating process. Anyway, enough about my stuff. What do you got?
So in continuing with the Alabama constitutional carry, since Shirley brought it up, and that's a great transition because that was one of the things that I planned to talk about today.
Ooh, a segue.
I love it. I love it when those things happen. I'm cautiously optimistic about the constitutional carry bill passing the Alabama Senate. So we'll see where that goes. All the signs are pointing towards that passing. However, and there's always a however, the opposite is happening.
We have Jim on the program for the howevers.
Yeah. The opposite is happening in the state of Indiana. So in Indiana, the House passed a constitutional carry bill, which moved to the Senate. And the first hearing that bill had in the Senate basically stripped away virtually all of what was in that constitutional carry bill. So they've changed it from a constitutional carry bill to a bill that keeps license requirements in place, but enables qualified candidates who have applied for a permit to carry a firearm without the permit until they receive the permit.
What?
Did that because one of the reasons that was argued in the House in Indiana for constitutional carry was that in Indiana there can be often significant amounts of time between when a person who could legally possess a firearm submits their permit and when it finally gets approved by the state. And there are all sorts of things that could happen to a law-abiding citizen where they might need to use a firearm in that time. So rather than doing the correct constitutional thing and creating constitutional carry, the Senate, because of rhinos within that Senate committee, decided to just take that one argument for constitutional carry and say, okay, well, we'll fix that a different way. And that, by the way, that amendment passed in the Judiciary Committee in the Indiana Senate by a 6-5 vote with a portion of the Republicans on that committee voting to change the bill. So,
of course they did. This is why I'm still unregistered from the Republican Party. I was intending to re-register before the midterms, but quite frankly, I'm so disgusted with them. I think I'll stay independent. I think my conscience won't allow me to join a party that doesn't, you know, do what they're supposed to do, that doesn't take any advantage, that doesn't use the power that we want them to use in order to maintain our freedom and rights. So we should distinguish between open carry and constitutional carry, because I think there might be folks a little confused on that.
Sure. So open carry just means that there is a legal method for you to carry a firearm in the state without concealing it. In most states, open carry doesn't require a license, but in some states it does. Constitutional carry allows you to carry a firearm without having to get prior permission from the government. So there is no license requirement. The fact that you are a citizen who is not a prohibited person is all that's necessary for you to carry a firearm in those states. So it is, as it sounds, it is carry according to the Constitution. You should not have to ask permission to be able to carry a firearm and defend yourself.
And anybody that argues against that should be, you know, unelected, primaried, removed, gotten rid of. They're just, you know, get them out of office. Because
but
the idea that
people... a quick question?
Shirley, go ahead. Yes.
Hey, I'm going to jump in here if you don't mind. Okay,
oh, please.
So,
never mind. Go for it.
Okay, so that doesn't mean that open... Just because you're constitution of carry, is it default to open carry?
So it depends on who is defining constitutional carry. In my definition, because I think the word constitutional carry should have a very pure definition. So in my definition of constitutional carry, you are allowed to carry a firearm open or concealed without a permit at all. There are some people who would contend that you have constitutional carry if they allow you to carry either open or concealed without a permit. I think that that is an incorrect definition of what constitutional carry is. And I think most people's definition agrees with my definition that without a permit, you may carry either open or concealed. You get to decide how you would do that.
So basically it boils down to how it's written in the state.
Yes.
How it's written in the law. Okay. All right.
Yeah,
I like
yeah, Shirley,
when you ask me questions I can answer, Shirley, because that doesn't happen often.
then they're my questions.
We're on a roll today, right?
That's right.
I want to add something real quick, since I'm going to have to split here. But you were talking about the wait period. I think I caught part of it as I was running around doing some other things. The wait period, some people, like New Jersey, you have your wait period to get a firearm. And there was this woman that boyfriend or husband was threatening her. She applied for a concealed carry or a permit to carry, a permit to even purchase a firearm, I believe. And it was supposed to take, I don't know, weeks, and it took months. By the time she never got that, he killed her. So that's the stuff like this happens, and that's why all this wait period and getting permission, it's taking away our right to defend ourselves, and people are dying because of the gun control. They're being killed because of the gun control. Just wanted to put that in here.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%, and the only thing that it does is cause innocent law-abiding people to be killed or seriously injured. Because at the time you apply, you are either a prohibited person or not a prohibited person. If you are a prohibited person, then you are already violating the law by possessing and carrying that firearm. If you're not a prohibited person, then you shouldn't have to go ask permission to carry it. You know, the fact that someone is going to carry a firearm when they're a prohibited person is not going to be deterred by the fact that it becomes a misdemeanor in the state to not have a carry license when you're carrying. They're already committing a federal felony by doing it. So the added on misdemeanor means absolutely nothing to someone who is already breaking the law. All it does is stop someone who is trying to act legally from being able to defend themselves.
Oh, she's still there or not? She might have had to go do other stuff.
I'm here.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, you're, okay.
I'm totally. Yeah.
Are you thinking?
Yes. Well.
Yeah,
but,
it's live
yeah.
radio. I don't have thinking time. I'm sorry. No. Go ahead, Shirley.
No, that pretty much summed it up perfectly. We kind of talked about that.
Yeah,
gun control bills don't stop the criminals from committing the crime because, in the first place, they are going to break the law anyway. Their intent is to break the law. Why adding or how adding another law is that going to protect anybody?
Yeah. What if we start calling it rights control? Whenever someone says, well, what do you think of gun control? I say, you mean rights control?
You're controlling my rights? Well, I'm against that. So you reverse the whole question there. And Shirley and I talked about this earlier, Jim, about the power of language. And I never use the term gun control. I never use the term assault weapon. It's always freedom rifle. You know, I turn these things around as much as possible, you know, so that it becomes what it really is. Well, it's not gun violence. Well, guns are a tool. Guns, you know, guns fire bullets. Okay. It really is the intent of the person who's holding it. So what you're really talking about is criminal violence. So if it's rights denial or rights control, you know, you frame the argument differently, and the words create images. The words create, a box that you put the other person in. As they're trying to put you in the box, what do you think of gun control? You know, are you for it or against it? Well, I'm against rights control. You know, you haven't answered. You've actually gotten out of the box that they put you in. See, most questions are designed to put you in a box and get a predetermined answer that they want. Well, why do you need an assault weapon? Well, I've never used the word assault weapon in the answer, because now you've used their language, their box that they put you in. And this is why it's so critical to get away from that kind of stuff. And so, it makes for entirely different debates. Constitutional carry. You know, the first question you would ask any politician is why is it you're violating the Constitution with government permission? In fact, Jim, I would even, you know, reverse how you talk about it a little bit. In other words, you're saying you don't need the government's permission. You know, implies that, well, maybe you do need the government's permission, or why is government's permission even in this? So I would phrase it, in a fashion that constitutional carry is where the government complies with the Constitution, and that you can openly or conceal carry as you see fit. So constitutional carry is where the government actually is brought back in and complies with the Constitution, where they're supposed to be. So then you put the onus on the government as opposed to government permission on you. It's a subtle difference, but I think it makes a difference in the overall debate.
I agree with you. In fact, you know, demonstrating how words can have meaning and impression on people. Mm-hmm. When I am talking to someone who doesn't know me and doesn't know what I do in my, I'll call it spare time. I don't have a lot of spare time, but in my non 9-to-5 working time, instead of telling people that I belong and work with a large gun rights or Second Amendment group in Florida, mm-hmm. I usually tell them that I'm on the board of a large civil rights group in Florida.
Exactly. I was going to say pro-civil rights group. Yes, perfect. Yes. You know, kudos to you. That's exactly. I'm happy. It's great. Yeah. And we need to, I actually published an article at Canada Free Press, you know, my conservative glossary. I go over all kinds of terms like that, turning gun-free zones into gun freedom zones, or calling a gun-free zone a victim disarmament zone, you know, and there's just all these different things you can do to the language to make it entirely different. I got a question for you, Jim. And then we get a little bit of time here, at least I hope. Remember when I was talking about having 500,000 AR-15s, you know, shipped over to Taiwan so they could defend themselves against China? And you said there was some problem with the Import-Export Act or something like that. I wish the same thing had happened for Ukraine. It'd be really nice if they could have the means to defend themselves, you know, since they were disarmed, you know, voluntarily of their Russian nukes when they got their independence in like 91, 92. And the Clinton administration bravely said, we will defend you. Trust us. Look how that's worked out. Anyway, but they actually love their folks. Yeah,
I agree that
the laws. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree that it would be great if we could have armed them. The law that you're talking about is it's a import-export law for arms, and it's the international. I think I'm going to screw this up. It's the ITAR, International Treaty on Arms Restriction or something like that. But it was passed by the U.S. And so the U.S. government could still say, yes, we want to send or we want to allow individual groups to send firearms to another country. But you have to get a license in order to do that. And anyone who were to send, say, 500,000 guns to the Ukraine for their use without going through the Department of State would probably find that their license to sell firearms internationally was revoked very quickly.
Okay. Well, the State Department's not going to do that because they don't, you know, they're the disarmament, you know, department. Yeah, they're the nuclear disarmament department. That's their job. You talked to Dr. Peter Pry on Mondays. He hates the State Department. It's really funny. But you know, Ukraine was calling for arming their citizens just last week. They should have done it years ago, but especially when they were disarmed. But this is why it is so important for a population to be armed. And you know, all these different countries, you know, Australia, they lost their guns. And when we talked to Jan Clark in Australia and Jennifer Clark in Canada, it's just funny, we have, you know, two such similar names in these two countries, you know, and they say, well, we didn't know this was ever going to happen. And those of us on the show here, especially, you know, the Gun Friday folks, we knew, you know, we knew that once you lose that right, it's only a matter of time before everything else, you know, can be taken away. It's interesting, too, that the same exact powers that Trudeau exercised, his martial law powers, you know, our president, you know, not Brandon, he's illegal, but a lawful president has those same executive orders and those same powers if they choose to invoke them. And I think that's a potential problem, too. Anyway, there's a bunch for you.
Yeah, it is. and like you said, while it is interesting that the Ukraine is pushing for that state of emergency to grant the right to bear arms to citizens. There was actually a good article in the National Review this week by Charles Cook that discussed the fact that this is too little too late. You know, arming a citizenry while an invasion is happening is not going to do much to move the needle.
Yeah, kind of like introducing a vaccine after the virus is already here. If I can throw that in.
I mean, in this case, you know, that's fine that people who didn't have firearms can have them, but you haven't had time to become familiar with them, to train with them. And, you know, according to the most recent data that's out there, there's about 1.5 million civilian-owned firearms in Ukraine. So Ukraine, by European standards, was fairly liberal in gun laws.
Well, that's interesting. You know,
by freedom standards, they were not. But, you know, in comparison to other European countries, they were fairly open with it. But that was 1.3 million firearms in a country of 43 million people. You know, in the United States, there's, by most estimates, more than 400 million firearms owned by civilians. So that's
with a population of 330 million, many of whom are older or younger and not really in a position to use them.
And, you know, if you look at places where the population has been able to repel an invasion, so you look at, you know, the United States before we were the United States, prior to the American Revolution, Vietnam, Afghanistan multiple times. These are countries where firearms were already present in the country before the invasions happened or before the fighting happened. So you had people who were familiar with them, knew how to use them, and were comfortable with them. They probably owned plenty of ammunition. So you have a ready force already. You don't have that in the Ukraine where you have someone who's never used a firearm and then all of a sudden you hand them an AK-47 and say, go forth and fight the Russian horde. That's
exactly,
just not going to happen.
Yeah. No. And I wouldn't expect it to. This is why this has to be developed, you know, long-term, way ahead of time. My favorite example of this is Switzerland. And I went to Switzerland. I visited Switzerland. It's absolutely perfect and absolutely boring. I mean, it's the most amazing place on earth. I mean, everything is, I mean, even the grass is all manicured to the same height. I mean, there's no place like Switzerland. But everybody's armed. You know, and Switzerland hasn't been invaded in some 400 years. And yet I saw Swiss Air Force jets flying over regularly. They got two things in their favor. One, shooting is a national sport. And two, they got mountains. So it's not easy for an invading army to do that. But everybody talks about Switzerland as being neutral in World War II. Well, so is Holland, Belgium, Norway, France, you know, all these different countries were, you know, Poland. They weren't declaring war on anybody. Well, France maybe. But all these countries were invaded by Nazi Germany, except Switzerland. And so the idea that Switzerland was neutral is a misnomer because they don't want you to know that the reason the Germans didn't invade Switzerland is because the Swiss were armed to the teeth and that you may be able to invade a country, but the occupation
isn't going to be able to happen because eventually all the soldiers are going to get killed, you know, and so, and their arms are going to be stolen by the locals and they'll be using it against them like the French resistance. And so it's a fascinating thing that if Ukraine were armed to the point where, yes, you could invade because they do have, you know, tanks, guns, airplanes, all that kind of stuff, but can they stay? Is it worth the cost of staying knowing that everybody, that there are arms circulating with the civilian population in huge amounts, and as they kill the invading army, they're going to take their arms and ammunition and use that against them too. And so I see an armed populace as a deterrent. You know, same thing with Taiwan. You know, Taiwan, I don't think can stop a full Chinese invasion. They can't. But they can sure make them miserable. The occupation could be so costly it's not worth it. That's how I see it.
Yeah, yeah, you definitely find that. You know, look at Afghanistan for the classic example of that. You know, mm-hmm. both the Russians and the Americans, you know, tried to control Afghanistan. So you've got
British.
The two, arguably the two most powerful armies in the world,
yeah.
Trying to control Afghanistan. And because of, as you said, the arms prevalence within the mm-hmm. country and the fact that the terrain is so difficult to navigate and control, it was impossible to control and maintain a presence in that country long term. So
yeah.
we didn't learn our lesson very well from
Russians. To Hannibal. Hannibal's elephants and Alexander the Great, didn't they dabble in Afghanistan too and get horribly killed?
Yeah, and I mean eventually, and you know, the other problem is, you know, Americans really don't have the stomach for a long-term occupation. So, you know, we won virtually every battle that was fought in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
But, you know, even though they were taking significantly more casualties than we were, mm-hmm. eventually Americans get tired of their sons and daughters coming home in caskets and start fighting to have the forces withdrawn. And we saw that happen. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing that we withdrew from Afghanistan. I'm just saying the Afghans yeah. knew and were playing the long game that eventually the Americans will tire of seeing bodies come home in caskets and they'll leave. Mm-hmm. And then we'll get our retribution. And that's what we're seeing now.
Oh, Vietnam is the same thing. You know, they knew
yeah.
eventually we couldn't stay there forever. You know, you can't project power across that much of the world, maintain the supply lines, maintain the cost, and subjugate a people, because sooner or later, you know, it's just the cost becomes prohibitive. The lives, of course, become prohibitive immediately, I think. And so I'm very careful, you know, when I talk about advocating wars in places. I think small, you know, special forces operations, get the job done, get out. You know, are much more effective. The most effective things I think Trump ever did in the Middle East was Soleimani and al-Baghdadi. You know, you kill one person and you stop entire armies from acting. That's pretty efficient, you know, for minimal loss of life or injury to Americans. You get in, you do your job, you get out. You do what you have to do and you leave. And this idea of nation building, this is where the State Department ruins us. The idea of going in to build things up. You know, what did Brandon think he was going to do in Ukraine? You know, do you think sanctions are going to hurt? You know, I heard a report, One American News, Derek Hawley, Reach Out America, Reaching America, was talking about the fact that Russia makes far more money from Europe and the United States because we have to buy oil from Russia now, which is kind of interesting. They make far more than the sanctions would cost them. So the sanctions don't matter. They're making way above the cost of the sanctions, so the sanctions are meaningless. So why not invade? Why not, you know, take the resources, the uranium, the tungsten, the titanium, the oil, the different things that Ukraine has, you know, and get a friendly government? They don't have to suppress the entire population of Ukraine. They just have to change governments from our corrupt government to their corrupt government. Yeah, and none of this stuff really
exactly.
gets talked about. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, and, you know, one of the things that frustrates military officers, especially at mm-hmm. the senior level, mm-hmm. is when we go in to a country and we don't have a well-defined end state of when we will exit the country.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, having some amorphous kind of, this is what our end strategy is going to look like, leads you to things like we had in Afghanistan, where we're there for years and years and years, you mm-hmm. know, as opposed to something very simple, like we are going to go in, we are going to make the country military in X, combat ineffective, and we are going to replace the current government with a pro-democracy government, period. and then we go in, we crush the military, we put the government in, and we leave. You know, that is something that we understand we can do in the military. When you start doing these long-term things, I think everyone in the military who's been around for a few years knows that that just doesn't work, because we don't have the stomach for long-term occupation. And because of our system of government, where we change parties over and over, you don't have the consistency that you would in an autocratic country, where someone who is ruling with an iron fist can say, I'm going to stay here and stay the course for 20 years if I need to. You know, that's not something that we have because of the type of government we have.
Well, that's a good thing that we don't have that. But even even in the dictatorships, you know, the reason that Kim Jong-un, you know, is so draconian, destructive, and, you know, as much of a demonic leader as he is in North Korea, he knows damn well that if he shows weakness, someone's going to kill him and take over.
Right.
You know, so the control on the dictators are all the enemies of dictators. That's why Stalin killed everybody that might be in his opposition. You know, I mean, don't be his friend. And the left doesn't understand this, that leftists kill other leftists in the millions. You look at Russia and Nazi Germany. That was a left on left war, you know, for power.
Yeah.
And people, you need to understand that the left, these people think if you suck up the tyranny, that, oh, I'm going to get power. I'm going to be part of the left. I'm going to be part of the Brandon insurrection. You know, they don't realize that the left turns on the left. You know, unless you prove your ideology every day, unless you prove your worth, and if you ever become a threat, the first thing they can do is get rid of you. Look at Joe Manchin and the Christian Cinema. You know, good Democrat, you know, independent thinking people. And now they're completely demonized, and now they're persona non grata. You know, the left psychology, and you know, Shirley will talk about this when we talk about the difference. I mean, it's language, it's everything. You've got to prove your worth to the left every single day. And so the restraints on Putin are the fact that he's got thousands of people that would gladly take his place if he ever showed weakness and let them. So it's almost, in some ways, I feel he was almost obligated to go in given the opportunity that Brandon created by surrendering in Afghanistan. And I'd call it a surrender. You know, you can't call it a withdrawal when you abandon Americans. You abandon $82 billion worth of weapons, you know, let the Taliban have them, and you bring out 100,000 Muslims to change the electoral balance of the United States. You know, that's an Obama operation, and that's an Obama surrender. Anyway, we're off track.
Can you imagine if the $82 million worth of weapons, instead of being left in Afghanistan, were brought to, say, the Ukraine?
Yeah, I thought of that. No, you're absolutely right. You know, that would have been perfect. Well, here's the thing. The Ukrainians, those weapons, weren't they for sale in like, the streets of Mogadishu? Didn't they end up in Somalia on the open arms market? I mean, couldn't they have bought them dirt cheap?
Yeah, I'm sure they probably could have, or just gone to Afghanistan and buy them, because I'm sure they were for sale in the markets of Afghanistan.
Yeah. So there's but I'm not even sure the structure of the Ukraine government. I don't even know how they work. You know, how autocratic are they, and how sympathetic are they to Russia anyway? And how many ethnic Russians are in eastern Ukraine that are really happy with what's going on right now? You know, this is why it gets complex.
Yeah,
we still should have made it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, so one more quick story before I go, because I do have to run. I can't stay super long today, but I wanted to get to one more just because it's a story that's going to strike home, or at least close to home for you.
Okay.
And that is the story about the gentleman, the sex offender, the convicted sex offender, who shot a deputy in Florida on Tuesday night. And then in an act of, I guess, showing the lack of intelligence that I would expect from someone who is a convicted sex offender and decides to shoot a law enforcement officer in Florida.
Wow.
This guy decided, as he was fleeing, that it'd be a good idea to flee to the panhandle of Florida.
Oh, great.
Which is
my neighborhood.
Probably one of the most gun-friendly parts of Florida you could go to. There's a reason that we refer to it as Lower Alabama.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I don't take that as an insult at all. I think that's a perfect compliment.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Bam,
I
out here,
either.
I got myself a gun. I care about
right.
guns.
I,
we got
I love,
good stuff. Yeah, go ahead.
Love
yeah.
the panhandle. Love the people of the panhandle. And then to compound things, out of all the places in the panhandle of Florida to flee to, he flees to Dixie County, which, once
Where's
again,
that?
I mean, just look at the name. Dixie County, probably not the place you want to flee to. And then to compound his mistakes, he decides that he's going to break into a home in Dixie County in the morning.
Oh, God. Did he live through this ordeal?
As he was breaking into the home, the homeowner heard him, mm-hmm. and they engaged in a gunfight in the home. The homeowner was injured, although not seriously injured, and the sex offender was killed. So, yay, good guys. Yay, guy with a gun. And, you know, that's why you need to have firearms, because there is no time for the police to come when this sex offender who has already shot a police officer decides that he's going to break into your house and take it over.
Yeah, the gun control laws really don't apply at that point. And I use that word only out of convenience for people to understand. But laws restricting, you know, magazines and license time and people, you know, gun laws get people killed. But this, at least in the panhandle of Florida, that's why I like living here. You know, and imagine this, Jim. I went from, you know, the San Francisco Bay Area to the panhandle of Florida. You know, you want to talk about coming back to America? It's so nice here. Even when I got fired from my radio job, I said, I don't care. I'm not leaving here. I like it here. These are good people. You know, I'm at home. Our county sheriff is so pro-gun that if he pulls you over, county sheriff, Sheriff Johnson, and in fact, I've had lieutenants tell the story, and you know, he's been on the show. He knows me. And so Sheriff Johnson, if he pulls you over, and he still does, you know, regular patrol, and you're a concealed carry person, and you don't have your gun, he yells at you for not having your gun. So what the hell's wrong with you? I mean, how can you protect the population? How can you do your civic duty if you don't have your gun? And this is coming from law enforcement. This is what it's like to live here. It's wonderful. Yeah,
that is great. And especially for someone, like you said, coming from the Bay Area of California, I mean, that's like being stranded on a Pacific island and having nothing but coconut for 10 years and then being brought into a 4-star restaurant and given a menu and saying, order what you like.
Oh, yeah. So I got Josie in life. You got just a couple more minutes. I want to get her on. But what was really fascinating when I drove here from California, the first thing that happened was that my first stop was in Arizona. Of course, they have open carry in Arizona. I'm sitting at breakfast at one of the local diners, and four guys walked in with 45s openly carried on the hip, cocked and locked. And I said, oh, God bless, I'm back in America. I said, what a wonderful sight. You know, I thought, four guys, this is great. And leaving California behind is so fascinating. I've also got Jonathan in the line, too. They both called in, which is fine because I got this time open right now. So, Josie, do you have a question for Jim just before he goes? You're live.
No, I don't have a question, but I would like to make a comment about Ukraine and people with no guns in the Ukraine. It's very difficult right now.
You've been there, so what's going on?
I cannot communicate with nobody in Kiev right now. I have a lot of people in Kiev that I know. Their communications are down, and they're trying to reach to kill the president. I was told by my missionary leader this a few minutes ago, actually. Mm-hmm. So it's a mess. It's a mess over there. But I feel sad that people don't have weapons to fight back like we do here. So I love my Second Amendment.
Yeah, and you know, like she said, that it is very, very difficult right now in Kiev. They are, as I understand, looking for the president of the Ukraine. There have also been multiple rocket attacks on Kiev. So Russia is able to range Kiev with rockets now and are firing them into the city. So it is definitely a dangerous place to be right now.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's, and this is a question for both of you, then I got Jonathan, I want to get to him in CPAC. Do you think this is more a coup, a transfer of power to a pro-Russian government, or an attempt to take and actually hold Ukraine as a nation, you know, like they used to hold countries back after, you know, during the Cold War? Let's go Jim and then Josie. Jim, what do you think?
So my gut feeling is that it is probably the former. The Russians will depose of the Ukrainian government and put in leaders from the Russian portions of the Ukraine, and probably allow, you know, representation from some other areas of the country, but ensuring that Russians maintain control. And they may keep an occupying force in for a period of time, and they will probably keep forces ready at the border. Should they have to return, but I don't know that they necessarily want to occupy Ukraine long term.
Yeah, I agree. I think that makes sense. Jesse.
My opinion is China is behind this whole thing with the Democrats. They're trying to take over Ukraine because that's what China's been running some of the oil in Siberia for a long time because the Ukrainian people are always so drunk, the men. So China's been involved for the last 10 years with the oil closer to the Ukraine. So the Democrats are behind this in China because Russia signed a peace agreement with Ukraine, which, of course, it could mean anything too, but there is something going on, and I'm trying to find out. I'm having a hard time getting to Kiev right now, though, but we'll find out. We'll find out for sure.
Yeah, feel free to break into any show and let me know what you find out, Jesse. That'd be good. Jim, go ahead, and then I'll get to Jonathan.
I was just going to say, Thank Greg, you. I would add that while I don't think they will occupy long term, I think it would be naive to think that they won't leave a fairly substantial number of Russian special operations forces within Ukraine, probably either in civilian clothes or wearing the uniform of whatever puppet government they put in, just to ensure that they keep control.
Advisors. Here's what we're advising you if you want to live. Yeah, I can see how that
Well, or they'll just pretend that they're Ukrainian. I mean, it's...
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious about the China involvement. I don't see that yet, but that doesn't mean it's not there. But I think energy really ties a lot of this together. Yeah. Jim, thank you, as always. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you. Always a pleasure. Always pleasure to be on, and you can find Florida Carry at floridacarry.org on the internet, and you can reach me, Jim, at floridacarry.org. Thanks, Greg, and I will talk to you next week.
Sounds good. Thank you, sir. All right. Jonathan, back to you, Jonathan.
Hi, I have a little bit.
Direct from CPAC. What's going on?
Well, I'm on the Uber over to there because I had to take some time to write some letters to try to get Fox to interview Oath Keeper Stuart Rose and things from jail. So, but I'm about over there. I was going to maybe comment. In fact, I was interviewed at the AP about Ukraine and Biden's mishandling of it. And I pointed out, I don't think anybody's handling it well, including him. So, including Putin, because I think everybody's well, shall we say, thinking below the belt instead of with their heads, and overreacting and everything. So it is a topic. It's amazing how much the topic is here at CPAC is not about. It's kind of ignoring, going on as scheduled. I suspect today, of course, Trump is supposed to speak, I think, today. And usually they have a big speaker at the end,
don't get locked out. Make sure you're in when he speaks. Otherwise you'd be standing outside for an hour and a half. That's what happened to me last time.
Yeah. Digitally, they do the Reels programs anymore and it doesn't work very well. They never like to, the Secret Service never likes just to announce exactly when.
So Trump's not going to be there. He's going to be on a screen or something. He's not going to actually be at CPAC.
I don't think so. I doubt it.
Oh wow!
No,
well,
I'm
that's
saying that
better.
The program is the program is digital, so you can't really tell what the heck is going on because it's really.
Ooh.
The allure of software and technology is usually a failure. So usually falls short rather than just the old school paper program. So most of it, there's a lot of great stuff about Woke Incorporated. James O'Keefe was absolutely amazing. He outed about 2.5 years ago a CNN reporter and kind of burned him about saying things about CNN. And this guy said he'd been there 25 years. He said, I'm not going to walk it back. I'm going to stand by what I said. He ended up going to work for James for Project Veritas. The former CNN reporter who got, was part of a big story is now working with James O'Keefe.
Did they mention his name?
A speech yesterday.
I'm just curious. Who it was?
Yes, but I forgot. I mean, it's up on like Gateway Pundit, and his goal is to hold the media accountable and trying to get them back to being what the media used to be and stop being propaganda. I mean, he just let he roasted the media in terms of just being propaganda and trying to call them back to ethics and back to truth and back to actually reporting the news instead of just being obvious propaganda. They used to speak truth to power. Now they're just representing the power.
Now they are the power. I had Project Veritas on. I had their number two person on back when I was at WBY, and so I've been trying to reach them again. Of course, they're a lot bigger now, and there's more stuff going on. But I would love to work with Project Veritas, and if you talk to any of the folks there, in terms of investigation. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, once somebody gets off the stage, they're mobbed and they're whisked away. So then I saw him in the hallway and he had like 150 people around him.
Yeah.
But with this new hire, mm-hmm. I think they're getting more organized so that you can reach them and get a call back and get better coordination. So the goal was that they're trying to be more organized and more effective. So. And of course, James O'Keefe talked about how he was raided in his home. Mm-hmm. I've talked to National File about Ashley Biden's diary, and I actually know quite a bit about it. But it was given to Project Veritas it was left behind at an apartment in a therapy residential therapy place. She just abandoned it in a suitcase. Somebody turned it in and gave it to Project Veritas. Veritas decided not to run with it.
Wow.
And someone leaked it to National File. And National File published it. And based on that, they raided James O'Keefe's house, and a journalist just to find out about an abandon. I mean, just to harass. And it has nothing to do with the FBI. Mm-hmm. It's just that she left her diary behind. That's her problem. It's a landlord-tenant issue. So he talked about that, and that's creating, of course, big news. Now, the biggest news here so far yesterday was Ron DeSantis. He is an amazing politician.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he hit every note perfectly, and I don't think I've ever seen a more skilled politician, including Ronald Reagan, because he came out throwing out hats, which, you know, creates a visual.
Mm-hmm.
You see that, when they replay snippets, he's like energetic. He's got the powerful, like, you know, football war music, and he's just absolutely perfect. So I'm, you know, just was more impressed than ever.
We got the best in Florida, Ron DeSantis. You're right, Jonathan.
He's like I'm a harsh critic, and I've seen a lot since 1984. Mm-hmm. But I just have to say, like him or not, and I do. But whether you like him or not, he was incredibly skilled. Then he was followed by Mark Robinson, who I'd never heard of. Probably him. He's the lieutenant governor of North Carolina. He was magnificent. That guy is going places. He's a big black preacher guy.
He's a big black guy. Yeah, I know him. He's fabulous. He's the one that made that speech at the school board or someplace. Or it was as a result of a criminal assassination of several people. He says, "You always blame the gun owners first. You know, I'm an American citizen. I have my rights." And I said, "Why are you blaming me for the actions of criminals?" And he made a great speech. That speech put him in there. So Mark Robinson's wonderful. Yeah, I haven't heard him speak lately.
He was,
but he's going to go
play. I'd probably seen him without knowing who it was, but I really didn't know who he was. He was, I was on my way out to do something. And I stopped to listen. Yeah. He was a magnificent speaker and seemed on target things
well,
like
doing
that.
With Lieutenant Governor? Because if he's doing well as Lieutenant Governor, he may be headed for national office. I mean, I see big things. He was just a dad. He was just a parent. He just got up and spoke, but those are the kind of folks we need. Go ahead. Yeah.
Normally, of course, you think from Lieutenant Governor to Governor, but he cut such a strong path that he may not even need to go to Governor. He may jump higher. So that was very interesting. And then there was Mike Lindell, who, everywhere he went inside, and I was trying to get his attention, He went in and out and everything. There, he had a couple hundred people around him all the time trying to take his photo. He's also a lot, again, I'm a harsh critic when, I'll say when somebody needs to do something better or when they're doing it awesome, but he was also a magnificent politician, not just a speaker, not what you know of him, but his political skills, I thought were, because he would, most people come here, they have back entrances, they swoop them in and out, you don't get to see them. They're like, why did you bother to come? If you're not going to mingle with your supporters, why did you even bother to show up?
Yep.
And he must have taken 1,000 selfies with people. He took the time I was trying to get
Josie was in there. I know.
I would have tried to.
Oh yeah.
and he was very. I mean, so he understands the game. Mm-hmm. Like I say, love him or hate him, he knows what he's doing. Not just, you just see him on TV giving a speech, but I saw him playing, knowing the game. And he was very, very good at it, just for some guy who runs a business. And he loves his business too. Like somebody would, make some comment and he's, oh yeah, he's on the website. I mean, he knows he was as enthusiastic as a business leader as he was, someone wanted to talk about whether or not he had certain kinds of sheets, like, he's like, oh yeah, they're here, and they're like, he knew everything about it. And he was like excited about his business. So that was impressive. However, he was banned by CPAC, which of course I don't know if people realize CPAC.
No, why was he banned?
Source, because of Dominion. They wouldn't let him speak. And
oh, really?
The lawsuit
about
the election. Yeah, they. CPAC has a long history of favoring the swamp and banning real conservatives. CPAC about 20 years ago, for a couple of years, there were real conservative groups who held an anti-CPAC because they said the CPAC is just rhinos. Now, there's so many people who show up here that real conservatives dominate. But the organization is not a
it's a Republican booster club is what it is. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
It
is.
And the ACLU is known for for laundering leftist Republicans and making them look conservative. But anyway, but on Mike Lindell, they rig the ratings to make liberal Republicans look conservative, and that they had that reputation for decades.